So what I want to know are the views of the panel, should we stay or should we leave, on their views on the potential impact of trade in terms of access to markets, potential loss or improved trade, and things like that. So if I can ask someone on the Remain panel to start to address that issue, that would be great. Thank you.
Shall I go? Okay. Thank you, Paul, and thank you, Sevenoaks School. It's a pleasure to be here. So if we stay in the EU, trade will grow, and it'll grow from two main sources. First, we already do about half of our trade with the EU through the single market, which is the largest economic market in the world, 500 million people. It is quite a good market, but it's not a perfect market. It's optimized at the moment for manufacturing goods, which is where Germany excels. It's not yet optimized for services, which is where we excel. 80% of our economy is services. I'm not saying it does nothing on services. It does do stuff on services. But there is a big initiative now underway, which is a result of pressure by Britain to complete the single market in services. So that will be a big boost to us if we stay. Secondly, trade with the rest of the world. The EU has trade deals at the moment with 53 countries around the world, but there are more in the works. The big one is with America, which, apart from the EU, is our second largest trade partner. If we can do a deal with America, that will be hugely beneficial for trade. And then there are deals in the works with Japan and India, and an investment deal in the works with China. So there's quite a lot that's on its way if we stay. If we leave, on the other hand, we are throwing all of that up into the air. We don't know what sort of trade deal we would do with the EU if we left, but the Leave camp has been saying that they don't really need to be part of the single market. They don't want free movement of people, and no country has full access to that single market without agreeing to free movement of people. They used to say they wanted to be like Norway, and then they discovered that wasn't very good because Norway pays into the budget, it agrees free movement of people, and it doesn't have any vote over the rules of that market. So that would be vote, leave, lose control. Then they said, well, they'd like to be like Switzerland, and then they discovered that actually Switzerland wasn't very good because it didn't have what's known as a passport for our financial services industry, which is one-tenth of the economy. And it agrees to free movement of people, and it pays into the budget, and it has no vote over the rules of that market. So then about a couple of months ago, my friend Boris said that they'd like to be like Canada. And then, because Canada doesn't pay into the budget, and it doesn't have free movement of people, but it doesn't have very much access to that market. And so then he abandoned that idea. And then last week, we had Michael Gove, who is the campaign chair of Vote Leave, saying, well, he'd like to be part of a free trade zone, and he said, like Albania. So I think they're all over the shop. So what you can say is that trade would be up in the air and that trade with the EU would decline if we left, and for a period of time there could be turmoil. There'll probably be political turmoil, and there will, because we'll probably have a new government. Boris will probably be Prime Minister, Gove will probably be Chancellor of the Exchequer. And then there's a question of what about all the trade with the rest of the world? Well, President Obama said last week that if we left, we would go to the back of the queue. And then people on the other side, well, they said, well, President Obama, he's a lame duck. And anyway, he bears a grudge against us because of his half-Kenyan heritage. And that's why he doesn't have a bust of Winston Churchill in the Oval Office. He does have a bust of Winston Churchill outside the Treaty Room, which is his private office. And so we'd be. Then they said, "Well, he won't be president. He's a lame duck. He's a lame duck president." And then Hillary Clinton came out the next day and said, "Well, she agreed with President Obama." And so now, what are we left with? Hoping that it's going to be Trump in the White House? Well, I don't think that would be good for us. And then there are all those deals, those 53 deals, over 30 of them actually with Commonwealth countries that the EU already has. We would have to start from scratch with those countries. So whether it is with the EU, with some existing deals we have, including important deals with Commonwealth countries, or with America, where we're half pregnant with a deal, we would be setting back our trade big time.
Okay, thank you, Hugo. Let's throw that open to the Leave panel now.
Here we are in a school. If you were to go into the geography classroom, you'd see a map on the wall. And I think we all remember that map. We all have it at the back of our minds. And I think our view of the world was defined by those Mercator maps, which give Europe both an artificial size and an artificial centrality. An artificial size because Europe, given its latitude, always looks bigger on a two-dimensional map than it really is. And an artificial centrality because if you look carefully, the equator is not the midpoint on those maps. But whether or not they were geographically accurate, that world doesn't exist politically or economically. Just as the 18th century saw a shift in the center of world gravity from the Mediterranean to the Atlantic, so our generation is witnessing a shift from the Atlantic to the Pacific. As recently as 1980, the 28 countries that now make up the EU accounted for 30% of the world economy. Now it's 17% and falling. Over the last 10 years, China's economy has doubled in size. India's economy has doubled in size. Ethiopia's economy has doubled in size. But the economy of the Eurozone, incredibly, was the same size at the beginning of this year as it had been in 2006. My friends, we don't sit on great natural resources in this green, damp, exquisite island home of ours. We have to make our way in the world by what we buy and sell. That means we have to be where the customers are, and the customers increasingly are not in Europe. Well, let's look at some of the trade deals that the EU is doing, because Hugo didn't spell this out. As a member of the EU, we may not sign a bilateral trade agreement with any country outside the EU. Right? The day we joined, 1st of January 1973, Brussels assumed 100% control over our commercial policy. And let's look at where some of these trade talks are, even with our nearest allies and oldest friends. There is, at the moment, no free trade agreement between the EU and Canada, and therefore between the UK and Canada, because it's being held up by an unrelated dispute about access for Romanians wanting to go to Canada. And we can't do anything about that. There's no deal between the EU and Australia because it's being held up by some Italian tomato growers. Now, the Italian tomato growers may be right. I don't know. But how have we put ourselves in a position where we cannot sign trade agreements with these countries to which we're so closely linked because of unrelated vested interests on the continent? Hugo used a slightly tendentious phrase there. He said, about half of our trade is with the EU. I think he said about half our exports go.
No, I said trade.
Okay, about half of our trade.
49%.
Okay, well, let's look at how the EU functions as a market, as a recipient, okay? In 2006, the EU was taking 55% of our combined goods and services exports. Now, it's 45%. Where's it going to be 10 years from now? Where's it going to be 20 years from now? 30 years from now? How low does it have to go before we drop the bizarre idea that we need to merge our political institutions with those of some neighboring countries in order to have an input into their standards? You know, this idea, I mean, we ran through all the alternatives, Norway and Switzerland and Albania. I mean, of course, Michael Gove didn't say we should be like Albania. When you hear the Remain side alleging that, you can make an assessment as to whether to take anything else that they're saying seriously. The point that Michael was making is that every European country, every geographically European state, is part of a European free trade area, a tariff-free zone. You can travel from non-EU Iceland to non-EU Turkey without encountering any trade barriers. The only states that are geographically European but are not in that common market are Belarus and Russia. All of the others, the Isle of Man, Montenegro, Monaco, all of them, even Albania, have access to the European market. And I, you know, we're supposed to be terrified by this prospect of being like Norway, being like, oh gosh, not like Norway, not like the richest country in the world, or Switzerland. How miserable, eking out that wretched kind of ghastly existence like the poor old Swiss. Do you know what the two richest countries in the world are? Well, it's the two countries with the richest people in the world, according to the Legatum Institute Prosperity Index. Norway and Switzerland. Spot the connection. Okay, GDP is not everything. Yeah, money isn't everything in life. The United Nations does a measure of quality of life. It's called the Human Development Index. It looks at longevity, literacy, infant mortality. Guess who's at the top of that league table? Norway number one, Australia number two, Switzerland number three. So plainly some kind of horrible, miserable life is possible out there in the shadows, outside the European Union. We're a trading country. We're a maritime country. We have to be where the customers are. Every continent has grown over the last 10 years, except Antarctica and Europe. And there's no reason to expect this to change. The EU is convulsed with two crises, the Schengen crisis and the Euro crisis. And it's responded to both in the same way. In the same way it responds to everything, with more integration, more political amalgamation. And the question we face on the 23rd of June is whether to make those problems our problems. You see, we have alternatives. Because we kept our pound, no thanks to the people who are now saying we should stay in the EU, and because we kept our passport checks, we have other options. We can reorient away from the enervated, exhausted, declining Eurozone towards the bits of the world that have strong long-term prospects. We can pursue a different trajectory if only we have the self-confidence to take back control. Trading with our friends and allies in Europe, as every geographically European state does, but with that vital freedom to sign free trade agreements with countries in the rest of the world. Just today, to give you one example, today, the EFTA countries, Norway, Switzerland, Liechtenstein and Iceland, signed a free trade agreement with the Philippines. It took them 10 months to negotiate from start to finish. We are a nation of 65 million. Right? To Switzerland's 8 million, Norway's 5 million. We are the fifth largest economy in the world. We are one of five permanent seat holders on the UN Security Council. We have the world's capital city, the world's most widely spoken language. I think we might just about be able to get by running our own affairs, trading with our friends and allies on every continent, interested and involved in the affairs of every continent, including Europe, but living under our own laws.
Thank you, Daniel. I'd like to hear now, either from Tina or Tobin, as local business people, your views on how you think either staying or leaving the EU could affect your businesses and business in general. I don't mind which of you goes.
So, I'm pretty non-political in terms of where I am. But in terms of this argument, I've decided to get involved because I'm leading a business which is a £5 million turnover with 50 people. And I feel that somebody needs to speak up for our employees and our staff. And from our point of view, we're a spares distributor for printer manufacturers in the UK, but we also have direct contractual arrangements with Europe. So with Citizen, we have a sole distribution agreement to sell Citizen spare parts into Europe. And with Epson, we are one of three main pan-European accounts. For my business and our business in this in Borough Green, I think that those contractual arrangements would have a very finite life if we were to leave. We would probably lose around over a period of 1 to 5 years. It depends on how long those companies would choose to find other partners within Europe. We would probably lose around £1 million turnover. So in terms of aspirations for the business, we are a young management team. We want to grow the business. We want to do well for the local economy. But I think that that would be a major backstep for us. My background in economics, I've heard what Dan said and Hugo said. I'd like to bring this right back down to the microeconomics, which I studied when I was doing my degree, which is that trade is about individuals and businesses. And macroeconomics plays a part, government spending, what we do, imports and exports, but trade and generating wealth of this country is done by individuals and businesses. And I believe that trade in this country, not only my business, will be severely affected by a leave outcome because of the uncertainty. And we are already still struggling as a business to grow and to develop our business plans and to have another 5 years where we don't know what is going to happen and whether the Germans will still buy from us or the French. Or I think that would be a very, very difficult business arena for a lot of people. And you guys probably all work for companies which are directly or indirectly affected by trade in Europe. And I think that sometimes you just need to get down to the micro level and you need to think about you, your job, your family. And I think that I definitely feel we will be worse off on a micro basis by leaving.
Okay, thank you, Tina. Chris.
My personal view is, obviously, we need to come out. And the reason is, similar to what Daniel said, we are the fifth biggest economy, yet we're only the 22nd biggest country on the planet. We're in the G20, we're in the G8, and the In campaign seems to just compare us to the likes of Norway and Switzerland and Liechtenstein. And we have so much more to offer than that. But we don't seem to be able to back ourselves. The problem we've got, I mean, I deal with people, as Paul said when he introduced me, is we don't like change. Hence the scaremongery of if we come out of the EU, all of a sudden no one's going to want to deal with us. For me, the reason these trade deals take so long to actually happen is because we're trying to get agreement with 28 countries. 28 countries that are not remotely the same in terms of stature. And we import approximately 20% more from the EU than we actually sell to them. So to think that Germany aren't going to want to send us Mercedes cars or Porsches or BMWs, France aren't going to want to send us wine, cheese, Peugeots, it's just a nonsense, and we've just got to back ourselves. I mean, Professor Patrick Minford, who used to advise Margaret Thatcher, he'd done a costing on us coming out of the EU based on us having zero trade agreements at all, and his figures were, from day one, the standard of living would be 8% cheaper than staying in. Our trade would grow by 4% because we haven't got all these restrictions, all this red tape. So my view is there isn't an option. To stay in, we can't control our borders. And we're talking about letting Turkey into the EU. Only 3% of Turkey is actually in Europe. 97% of it's in Asia. I thought it was the European Union. But for me, I can't actually come up with a reason why we should stay. I've thought about it long and hard. For me, it just doesn't work in its current state. You look at unemployment, youth unemployment. If you look at the five largest countries in the EU, they make up about 65%. Of the population of the EU. Three of those countries, their youth unemployment is between 25 and 50%. it's just not working as it is. We try to go over there and get a better deal. We haven't got anything, really. You know, we've gone over there with a bowl to get a better deal. We can't even come back with a bowl. So it just doesn't work for me on any level.
Thank you, Chris. Tobin, you're a local farmer, primarily. I know you have other businesses. Mm-hmm. We have the Common Agricultural Policy. How do you feel that leaving or staying will affect trade and your trade specifically?
Well, I came at this initially. I've always been rather a Eurosceptic when I looked at this. And in the cold light of day, I've just looked, especially on the impact upon my business, because I'm primarily a sheep farmer. I think the sheep industry will be very hard hit by this. More than a third of our lamb sales are into Europe. And that's a big market to potentially lose, because we are much more competitive than most of the European livestock producers. We have an ample supply of grass. And according to the NFU produced a very good report, which I've been to a meeting the other day, and it was very thorough, from what I can understand. And it seems to show that sheep farmers specifically will lose out an awful lot if we go into the EU. Now, food production is at the core of an economy, ultimately. I know most of us aren't involved in farming. All we see from food production is when we go to a supermarket, we see some food stacked high on the shelves, and we don't really connect with how it's actually produced. But food production is very core to an economy. Even if it's a small part of an economy, it is very core to it. And I think we'd be mad to risk doing what we're doing by leaving the EU. I'm all for taking risks. As a business, we take risks a lot of the time. When we went into our air-dried lamb production, we were constantly sending off our legs of lamb to be tested to make sure that no one be poisoned, because we didn't want to kill anybody. And so this is happening an awful lot. And a number of other things we're doing, let's say, with the work I do with training dogs not to chase sheep, I insure myself so there'll be no problems in that respect. We just don't know what the outcome's going to be. And I was very impressed when I went to this NFU meeting. They had this model of potential examples of what could happen if we left the EU. And at the end of the day, they said, you know, they did this expensive modelling by some university in the Netherlands. And at the end of the day, he said, we don't really know. We've done all this modelling, but at the end of the day, we don't know what the result would be. The result, by the way, for UK farming, especially if farm payments are reduced, was very negative across the whole board. Sheep farming specifically will suffer, but across the board, if farm payments are reduced, then farming is going to really suffer if we leave the EU. So I would just urge you to seriously think about this. And think about the consequences for farming for all your businesses, because it could affect you in ways you don't realise. Are you really willing to take that risk? All the things that have been said here seem to be speculative. Do we really have hard facts? We don't know what we're entering into. If we leave the EU, do we really know we'll get these trade deals? We don't know. It's all speculation. I mean, that seems a massive risk to take with one's economy, with one's life. Do we really want to put that upon ourselves and upon our children when we don't know what's going to happen?
Okay. Thank you, Toby. John.
Not being a trade expert, I can sympathise with what Toby's saying and everything else, but it's interesting that I just was reading that Australia have just done a trade deal with the USA. It took them 10 months to achieve that, which is not bad. And I know Hugo said we were talking to the EU, we were talking to the likes of India, which I believe has been going on for about 8 years now. So it looks really good, that one. I know you're going to find this hard to believe, but I actually voted in 1975 I voted yes for the common market. And at that time it was to bring seven countries together as to trade with each other, which to us made sense. And hopefully, you know, the countries will flourish by trading, as we've always have done over the centuries. But the, I suppose, the bureaucratic monstrosity we have been left with now was nothing like what I voted for back in 75. And that's very disappointing. Somebody said to me the other day, John, it's now Thursday, and I want you to, you know nothing about the EU, and I want you to go and invest and become a member of the EU. Well, being hopefully a bit of a reasonable businessman, I would do my due diligence on how the EU was set up. And I thought about this, and I would do, I'd look at their P&L, because that's what we tend to do, us business people, and straight away a red flag will come up behind my back, because I can't, the figures, there's so many conflicting figures. Chris and I were talking earlier about figures, and there's so many conflicting figures about what is the true state of the EU. We don't really know, unfortunately. And that really worries me as a local businessman and as an Englishman as well. And I don't know. I think it would be great if we could actually, be inside the EU and change it. Unfortunately, I don't think we can or we ever will. And that's why I think we ought to come out.
John, thank you. So you've heard a range of views and explanations and thoughts and opinions from our panel. We're going to throw that open to the audience. Try to keep your questions and your statements as short as possible. You're going to have to direct your question to either Kirsten or Andrea, who will then repeat it so that we can hear it. We're going to take two or three questions from the audience before I go back to the panel so that we kind of speed the process up. So show of hands, who'd like to go first? Gentleman down here was first, Kirsten. If you could address your question to Kirsten.
I'd like to shoot this trade box straight away. I agree with the team that trade is between individuals and businesses. When I go to a pub to buy a pint of beer, that's trade. My wife goes in the same place to buy some takeouts, that's trade. Now, 90% of trade is domestic. There's only 10% of our trade is export. And of that 10%, only 49% of that 10% is to the EU. So we export a minuscule amount of that.
Okay, so I heard that question, so I can repeat it. The gentleman in front is saying that if you look at our overall trade figures, most of our trade is actually internal markets, and that which is ascribed to trade with Europe actually forms a very small, was it 9% you said?
No, 10%.
Okay, and 10% of that, okay. Okay, thank you. Another question for you. Somebody else had their hand up. Lady in the green jacket.
Thank you. I don't think I need the mic. There's about, according to the Treasury report in November in businesses, there's about 5.5 million businesses in the country. Only 6% of them trade with the EU, yet 100% of them have to deal with the regulations on businesses coming from the EU. Why is that? It's been estimated that the cost of these regulations is now amounts to something in the region of £33 billion per year as a burden on businesses. Why is that? And if we came out of the EU, could we do away with that?
Okay. I'm going to need to repeat it, otherwise we won't pick it up on the recording, which is why we need the mic. Sorry. So what the lady was saying there was there are 5.6 million businesses in the UK, only 6%. Actually trade overseas, so 94% don't do that, yet those businesses have to comply with EU regulations even though they don't trade there. Is that a fair summation? Okay, thank you. We'll take a couple more questions and then we'll go back to the panel. The gentleman in the middle there. I can't hear you, so you'll have to talk to one of the ladies.
We're a former trade negotiator, and I'm a Norwegian, and I also helped to run the agreement between Norway and the And I have to say that you can't just talk about trade agreements. There are different sorts of trade agreements. Just like there are different sorts of vehicles. We have bicycles, and you have the Airbus B380. You have the ATLA agreement with the Philippines, and you have TTIP, or the European Economic Area Agreement. So, come on, let's get real about this discussion. You cannot compare all trade agreements and say they're alike. The other thing I'd like
Hold on, because we've got to repeat this. So,
did you actually hear any of that?
I didn't hear. I couldn't hear that. Yeah.
I'll pass the mic down.
If you could keep it short so that we could pick it up.
Well, should I repeat the last question, or did people hear it?
Just try to repeat the crux of your point.
Well, I mean, what I want to say is there are all sorts of different trade agreements, and the trade agreement between EFTA and the Philippines is a very simple agreement which basically gives free access for goods. Then there are much deeper trade agreements. Britain needs the single market because what happens is the rules are harmonized across the single market, so all British firms, like Tina's, can export, and there's a common rule book. What will happen if Britain leaves is they will go out of the boardroom where those rules are decided, and they will let everybody else decide the rules for doing business in Europe. It will be catastrophic.
Okay, thank you. Right, let's try and deal with those points. Is everybody on the panel happy with what you heard there?
Yeah.
Who'd like to address some of those first?
Well, I think the first two were sort of criticisms of our side.
Go for it.
So shall I give an
answer? Yeah, go for it.
I mean, the first question, actually, the facts are not right. The number is 13% of our GDP is exports to the EU. So that's not just exports in total, it's exports to the EU. I admit it's not all of our GDP or even half of our GDP, but 13%, that's one-eighth, is quite a lot. You also have to put it in the context of what proportion of their GDP are exports to us. It's 3%. So actually when you look at it, there's an imbalance there. Obviously, they're bigger, therefore it's a smaller percentage. But that means that we are more desperate to do a deal with them than vice versa. There was, total rubbish. You may say it's total rubbish. We can talk about that afterwards, but let me answer the questions. Second is 6% of our businesses trade with the EU. I think that is correct, that figure, but that makes no allowance for the different sizes of different businesses. It treats a newsagent the same as British Aerospace. And so you have to think, actually, not what are the total number of businesses, but also the number of jobs that depend on those businesses. And when you talk about the regulations, you mentioned this 33 billion figure, which is from Open Europe, which is a Eurosceptic think tank. But if what is rarely mentioned by people who mention that figure, this is of the cost of the 100 most expensive regulations. They don't mention that there was also a cost-benefit analysis, and the benefits of those same 100 regulations, do you think that was 33 billion? Do you think that was 10 billion? It was actually 59 billion. So it's very misleading in doing a cost-benefit analysis to look at the costs but not at the benefits. And then you look at these regulations, and what are these, you know, top 100 regulations? And you actually have to think, well, would we want to actually scrap them even if we left the EU? So some of the most expensive regulations are our Climate Change Act, that is to try to stop or prevent too much global warming. Now, I know people like Nigel Farage and Nigel Lawson don't believe in global warming, but the British people, about 80% of them, think that we should be doing our bit to stop climate change. Another very expensive regulation, I think it's the second most in that list, is bank regulation, which actually we have done what people call gold plating. We actually do more in Britain to protect our banks than the rest of Europe does, because we've got a very, very big banking industry, and we saw in 2008 it almost blew up and dragged the entire economy down. Now, would we really want to scrap all the banking regulation when we left? There are also, then, if you look at the third most expensive regulation on that list, it's the so-called Working Time Directive. Now, there are people who want to scrap that, and I certainly think it should be tweaked, but there are a lot of people in this country who wouldn't want it scrapped. A lot of workers don't want it scrapped, and you also have to think, would we really scrap it? And then you also have to say, what has actually happened when the British government implemented that directive? Part of it was on holiday pay, and they had a choice as to whether to implement the rule on holiday pay. Holiday days, the number of holiday days that you should have, the minimum holiday days, whether they should
add in the bank holidays that we have. And they decided not to do that, with the result that we actually have 8 more days required holiday than we would require if we stuck to the letter of the rule.
We're going to address those issues later in the debate.
So let's just
stick to the core trade argument for a moment.
Thank you for that. The regulation was the point.
But we're going to cover that in more depth later in the debate. Thank you for that. Someone from the Leave side.
If I may, yeah. Okay, let's accept Hugo's figure, that it's only 13% of our GDP that depends...
Well, it's ONS figure.
Okay, ONS figure, fine. Means 87% of our economy that doesn't trade at all with the EU nonetheless has to apply 100% of all EU directives and regulations. And that's the big cost. Of course our exporters, if we leave the EU, will have to meet EU standards when they sell into the EU, just as we have to meet Japanese standards when we sell to Japan. But we would no longer have to apply all of those regulations to our domestic commerce and industry. And I don't think it's really right to be dismissive of the newsagents as opposed to British Aerospace. I think if you put those newsagents together, you end up with a lot of employment in this country. The vast majority of us work for firms with fewer than 20 people. Those are the wealth creators. Those are the entrepreneurs. And by the way, since there are quite a lot of them in the room, let me, as a politician, say thank you. Because, you know, we're very good in my profession at saying thank you to nurses and teachers and soldiers. And quite right, so we should be. But I wish that a bit more often politicians would also say thank you to the entrepreneurs who generate all the surpluses that pay for the nurses and the teachers and the soldiers and us and pay our salaries. So thank you very much. Although I am hoping that within a couple of years you will no longer be paying my salary because there won't be British MEPs anymore. And I wouldn't be inviting you to fire me if I were not confident that there'd be lots of openings for newly unemployed MEPs in the boom that will come after Brexit. Let me, if I may, also deal with one very good, true and important thing that Tina said. Governments don't trade with governments. Businesses trade with businesses. People trade with people. Now, I know that the Remain side is working very hard to make us all nervous about the transition. They're not really trying to make an argument that the fifth largest economy in the world couldn't survive as a self-governing country trading with its friends and allies. So they're saying, oh, yeah, but what about getting there? Even if you wouldn't join today, is getting out going to be too much of a hassle, too expensive? Will there be disinvestment and all the rest of it? Very important to understand the process. First of all, voting to leave is not a general election. It's a mandate to the government. It's like instructing your barrister. It's saying to the government, get us out on terms and within a timescale that you think maximises the benefit to us, while, of course, acknowledging the legitimate interests of our European allies. So that process is up to us to have, first of all, the informal talks and then to move to formal talks. I don't know when the Brexit would come into effect. Maybe it's 2018, maybe 2019, I don't know. But here's the key thing. The day after it comes into effect looks pretty much like the day before. The day after we leave, all of the technical standards that we've assimilated as EU members are in place. All of the trade deals are in place. All of the reciprocal deals on healthcare are in place. The day we leave is the day that we may start to diverge. It will be a gradual process. Of course, there will be areas that we want to diverge. Otherwise, there'd be no advantage in leaving. Of course, there are going to be things that we will want to disapply because we think that the costs outweigh the benefits. Equally, there will be areas where the other member states want to push ahead with much deeper integration without us. But it'll be a gradual reorientation. And the person who put this best, funnily enough, was the leader of the Remain campaign, Stuart Rose, who said right at the outset, his exact phrase is worth quoting, he said, it won't be a step change, it will be a gentle process. A gentle process. And he then went on, before his horrified spin doctors could shut him up, he went on to say, after 5 years, you will not notice any change. After 10 years, you'll notice the beginnings of change, and then after 15 years, then you'll notice some change. And that's exactly right. Britain, on the day after we leave, will start to pursue a different trajectory, back towards the more opulent and prosperous markets across the oceans. And so this idea of a disruptive transition, if until we've done a new deal with the EU, there isn't some sort of outer darkness. The existing arrangements stay in place until we move to the new ones. That's how it works. And that will only happen when both sides are content. One other thing, which I'll close with. Again, Tina was right to look at the microeconomics. And I want to quote two other leaders of the Remain campaign in terms of their prognoses of what will happen when we've left the European Union. One is our friend Lord Rose again, who said, when we leave, wages will rise. He saw this as a very bad thing, and perhaps in the circles where he moves, it's axiomatically seen as a bad thing, but I don't think it's seen as a bad thing by most people. And then Lord Ashdown last week says, well, if we leave, food prices will fall. Now, it seems to me if you're looking at the microeconomics, higher wages and cheaper food have got to be a pretty good thing. That's the leaders of the Remain side saying that, right? And that means more money in the economy, a virtuous circle, people with more to spend, a general boom. It's like a permanent stimulus. Only it doesn't cost the taxpayer anything. And that's before we even get into the savings that we're going to have, not having to send all this money to Brussels, which we're going to come on to later. So I think there are huge, bright, attractive prospects for us as an independent country. We just need the self-confidence. See, exactly what we were hearing from Chris, who knows about brains and neuroscience. There is a sort of risk aversion in us that makes us confuse the familiar with the certain, that makes us unwilling to do something new. But understand that there isn't a status quo option on this ballot paper. Right? It's a fork in the road. One road leads to common market, not common government, kind of deal enjoyed by every other country in Europe, you know, by the Guernsey or whoever. The other fork in the road, well, that's more crises, more bailouts, more of the migration disaster, more of the euro disaster, military assimilation, fiscal, economic. That road leads to ever closer union, and that's the choice we face as a country. And I know in my bones that a confident country doesn't fear to follow its own path.
Thank you, Daniel. Yeah. Before we leave the topic of trade, I want to make sure that this gentleman's question was asked. I'm kind of paraphrasing it because I only half heard your question. So if I get this wrong, I do apologise. I think you were saying that as far as trade agreements and trade within the EU is concerned, there are small trade things and there are big trade things. And there are big partnerships and things like that. So, you know, things like Airbus or something is a partnership to build an aircraft. Was that the thrust of your point?
I'll shout.
Yeah.
So, yes, there are different levels of complexity, and the EU has the most complex trade agreements that give the best access both ways.
Okay.
But the big question is to Mr. Hammond and his friends, how will Britain maintain influence in the boardroom, i.e. in Brussels, when rules are made about doing business in Europe, because that's where all the rules are made about doing business in Europe.
But of course, we will not have a formal say in the setting of standards in future. That's the trade-off. Okay, we keep everything that we've got up until now. We can start to disapply the more burdensome stuff. Okay, exactly. So for that 13% of our GDP that depends on the EU, we lose our current 12% input into how the rules are made. But the real top tables these days are not in Europe. They are global. The EU is shrinking. The year we joined, it was 36% of the world economy. Now it's 17%. Our exports to the EU are falling virtually by the day. There must come a point when we think that the prize of being represented ourselves in the global bodies that set the standards worldwide, whether it's for Codex Alimentarius or banking regulation or the internet or whatever, has to outweigh having some say in common EU rules, but then being represented at global level by 1/28th of the European Trade Commissioner, currently a Swedish sociology professor. Surely, as a country of the size that we have, the influence, the global reach that we have, we would do better being in control of our own policies and our own interests.
Fantastic. I want to hear from the other panel members now, and I want to recap on the questions, the series of questions we were asked and the points that were made, which, if I remember rightly, was that there are 5.6 million businesses in the UK. There are 68,000 in Kent, as it happens, and they're primarily small businesses, and only 6% of them trade externally at all. On the other hand, the gentleman here was saying, yeah, but there are some huge trade deals and there are some huge partnerships and some huge things that need to be managed at a macro level. So I want the other panel members' views on those two kind of poles of that trade argument.
So, yeah.
I mean, agricultural exports to the EU are rising. So from that respect, the agriculture is selling far more to Europe than it has been. I've got the figures somewhere. But anyway, it has been rising quite dramatically. And also, just going back to the red tape and bureaucracy business, Norway and Switzerland and Liechtenstein have to comply with almost all the same regulations as we comply with. So we're just going to still have to comply with all the red tape. I get so frustrated sometimes, all the red tape I have to comply with. But it's not going to change. It's going to stay the same. If I want to trade into Europe, which basically is one of our biggest markets, it's going to stay the same from an agriculture point of view. So we are going to suffer, and it's not going to make our life any easier. And I can imagine that's probably the same for Tina's businesses. We're still going to comply with these regulations. And it won't be just... We can't sort of split them up into different areas, saying we're doing this with Asia and this with Europe. We'll have to apply these standards across the board if we want to trade into Europe.
Cool, thank you. Anybody else want to come back into those points about the polarity of trade between small and large?
For me, we seem to be getting bogged down with all these agreements we need to have, and we're going to be losing out massively if we come out of the EU because we've got 53 agreements with different countries, etc. We've been going on for years trying to get an agreement with America, yet still between the EU countries and the states, there's about £2 billion a day of trade going on without an agreement. So common sense would tell us, surely we're better off to have our own free trade agreements than have to go through regulation after regulation after regulation. Just got some figures here about the cost of red tape. In 2006, it was estimated that EU over-regulation is costing the EU £600 billion.
Estimated by the Commission itself?
Yeah.
Yeah, by
Commission. £600 billion for red tape that isn't necessary. And, you know, that's quite a lot of money, isn't it? When you're looking at hospitals and education and et cetera, et cetera. We just don't need the red tape of it. You know, we've got Greece already asking for more money. How long is it going to be before Spain say, well, they've done that? Italy, Portugal, Ireland. Financially, it doesn't work. We tried to make it work, and we failed because there's just no flexibility there. If we can do £2 billion a day, the EU, without an agreement, with the fifth largest economy, as we said, we're Security Council permanent member of that. Only five countries in the world that are permanent members of the Security Council. The G20, the G8, we're just such a huge organisation, we just don't look very big on a map. But the facts are, we've done trade previously to being part of the EU in 73, 75, for hundreds if not thousands of years. We used to rule the world. You know, we need to back ourselves and put the great back into Britain. Because this is an opportunity that will probably never come round again. And there's nothing to fear but fear itself. We're just hearing all these scaremongering stories about how bad things are going to be. The only thing that we can all sit here and say is a definite is, if we leave, we can control who comes in and out. Other than that, all of this is partly speculative. But the fact is, like with the States, we do £2 billion a day in trade with zero agreements. Why do we need to waste this £600 billion on red tape that's unnecessary?
I'll just try and answer from my, I think what's, yeah, you absolutely. Want to ask our opinion. So the lady in the green jacket about the regulations, as a business owner, red tape it is very time consuming. Looking at benefits for members of my company as a whole, I think those regulations do us better rather than good. That's my opinion. I think that they help us to do right things by employees. It's mostly about employment law for us. And they help us. I think that from a Britain point of view, I think that the EU helps us stand up to big blue chip companies like Tesco's and Sainsbury's, who would, without any control, do whatever they wanted in terms of working time and so on, and paying overtime and minimum wages and so on like that. So that's that, the answer to that question. I agree with the man from Norway, and I completely agree that if we are out, we would have no control. I think I admire Dan Hannan and Nigel Farage for even being Eurosceptics, going in there and making their voice heard. I think that the European leaders... the young French economy minister, help me out here.
Macron.
Thank you. He said very recently on television, you know, the EU would be a poorer place without Britain for those reasons. And we absolutely do challenge the European groupthink, and we make Europe a stronger and better place for being in it, even if we don't always agree with them. And on the trade thing, the thing about that is it doesn't matter what that percentage is. We have, as a country, we are told, have a huge national debt, and it's about the wealth generation, and it's the net import-export balance that is important to our economy. It doesn't matter if it's 13% or 3%. What matters is that we have to try to attain a net positive export versus import. Otherwise, we will not generate the wealth to reduce that national debt.
Thanks, Tina. John.
Not being a trade expert, I suppose, is the EU not about trade, but really about, I suppose, a centralised federal government? That's what it strikes me as being. It was interesting, you said we've got 68,000 businesses in Kent, and probably 75% of those are 1 to 5 employees. And this, as Daniel said, are the heartbeat of this country, and long may it through. The world is a big place, and yes, it's right we should be looking at Europe, but there's a lot more outside. And as a sort of somebody looking in and saying, there's lots of other opportunities we can take outside of Europe. Yes, we mustn't neglect Europe. There's also a lot going on in other parts of this world, and I think we should start concentrating on them a lot more now. And why not? Let's go and do it. But at this moment, we're hamstrung with our agreements with Europe, and I'd like us to be, you know, let's get the physio in, and let's get out there and do some business with the rest of the world.
Okay, thanks, John.
Okay.